Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilik, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Well, this is episode number 40 of the Azure Podcast, being recorded on the 20th of August, 2014. My name is Sujit Mello. I'm a senior consultant with Microsoft in the app dev space based out of New Jersey. And on Skype with me, I have my esteemed colleague, Kale, and also a special guest. Kale, please introduce yourself and our guest.
So my name is Kale Teeter. I'm an MCS consultant in the New York, New Jersey region, focused on .NET development and Azure-related activities. And also joining us as a special guest here this week is Simon Gurevich. Simon, if you want to introduce yourself.
Hey, guys. I'm an MCS consultant. Have been with the company for 15 years, and I'm primarily specializing in Azure technologies, application development, distributed architecture.
Awesome. And we've been trying to get Simon on this podcast for a long time now, and I'm really happy that he finally caved in and decided to join us. But before we get started talking to Simon, I want to kick you guys off with a nice tip that we got wind of this week. This was something that I personally really liked seeing. And just to be clear, the tip that I'm about to give you exists in the old Azure Management Portal. So when you're on manage.windowsazure.com, and if you want to, maybe, you know, you're trying to troubleshoot something with support and you want to be able to give them some information about what version, et cetera, that of the portal that you're using, there is a special hotkey that you could press while you're on the old portal, and it's Control, Alt, and A, the letter A. And when you do that, those three, that combination, a little pop-up window comes up, and it shows you a whole bunch of diagnostic information, which, you know, turns out to be very handy. Like, you know, as I said, versions about the portals, your browser information, etc. So if you're having problems, that's what you can give out to support. So I thought it was pretty cool, and hopefully you guys can try it out. As I mentioned, it only exists on the old management portal, and I sincerely hope that they have something similar coming up for the new portal. So let's get to Simon. So Simon, you're like Kale and myself. Oh, I should mention that Evan's not with us today. He had an office party to go to. Lucky him. So he decided that was more important than the podcast. So we'll have to go without him today.
Nice.
He should be pretty drunk by now.
And Simon, as Simon introduced himself, he's a consultant in the app dev space, just like Kale and I am. And but he focuses a lot on Windows Azure as Kale does, actually. So Simon, you said you've been with the company 15 years, and you've probably seen, you know, Azure from its little baby steps until where it is today. How would you describe the journey that Azure has been through so far?
Yeah, that was quite some time already. I started working with Azure even before it was released and when it was known under the project name, not the real Azure term. So it has been quite a long journey. We started with primarily PaaS services, compute, web and worker roles, and then we diversified into the IaaS, virtual machines, networking, and all kind of complicated scenarios that you could pretty much now implement on Azure platform, migrating your infrastructure to the cloud.
Yeah, and I know we've talked about it in previous episodes. We've got a couple of very big names in the Azure team now. We've got Mark Rusinovich, who is one of the key members there. As well as
Cutthroat, yes.
He's obviously the big man in Azure right now. So a lot of firepower for Microsoft on this platform. How, where are we like today, just from a, like a very rough perspective, where are we with regards to the competition in the Azure space?
Well, we made quite a bit of progress right now, and these days a lot of on-premises scenarios could be pretty much migrated to the Azure cloud in a straightforward fashion if you have a standard developer stack and regular enterprise applications, whether it's web applications or NTR applications. You could pretty much map it into the Azure platform and in many cases to PES services if there is an application which is really specific to the enterprise and cannot be easily migrated to PES, you could always go with the lift and shift scenario and put it into the virtual machine in the cloud and then even extend your data center to the cloud by connecting on-premises environment using the VPN or other technologies that we have. So the breadth of scenarios these days is pretty substantial, and I'm sure for each and every customer, there is a pretty good, approach how you could migrate, start migrating your application to the cloud and, realize all those savings, just by not managing all your own infrastructure.
So, Simon, this is Kale. Just a couple questions about that. Just, you know, for the listeners out there, especially when we're talking about, you know, like startups and things like that. This is like, it seems to be one of the big things, especially, with, these cloud platforms that are out there where we can, essentially, if you have little money, you know, you're just getting started up, you're starting your company up, you don't have a lot of infrastructure. What would you say is your feeling as far as when someone comes in new, they know nothing about Azure, and they just say, I hear that there's a cloud offering here, and I hear you guys provide some services. I hear about PaaS, I hear about infrastructure. If somebody was brand new, maybe Greenfield, let's say, like it's a brand new application. I got this idea, the next Twitter, and I want to start building it. What kind of things do you would you look for yourself, even if you were in that position, and say, I'm going to go for websites. No, I'm going to go for platform as a service. No, I'm going to go for this. Having very little info into it, having a little, not much experience with it, what kind of key decision things would you look for to say, yeah, this is, I'm going to gravitate toward PaaS for this?
Well, first of all, for the startup, it would be pretty important to check out all that exciting stuff without incurring much cost. And they would be able to either create a trial subscription with Azure or use the MSDN subscription, which comes with Azure benefits. Also, quite a few PS services would be would have a free tier, for example, websites. Where you could deploy a website originally just to try it out. And if that website is rather small at the beginning, you might not necessarily pay anything. But from purely technical perspective, if it's a Greenfield application, the PaaS services are the natural fit to at least to try to design it in a new cloud world. You start with websites, for example. If it's a web application, it's easily scalable. You can scale it out as much as you need, depending on your user load, depending on throughput requirements, and eventually add more and more services. You could reuse the whole spectrum of PaaS services. I don't know, cache. Service bus, using all kind of regular distributed computing design patterns, implementing them in the cloud.
But Simon, just one thing I wanted to, I've always faced this dilemma when starting something new. So we have, you know, traditionally we've had the worker role and I should say the web role and the, you know, the service role available in PaaS, and then now we've got websites, which right. can also play do the same thing, right? They can do web services, then they can do websites.
Right.
How is somebody to choose one or the other? Like, why would one say, I'll do websites or I'll do the, you know, the web role, work role model?
Yeah, typically, these web application, whether it's a web service or website, can now be deployed either in WebRel or in a website. And even in website, you now have the background process. You can design background process using the web jobs. So I believe the guidance these days is mostly if you have a complicated end-to-end application on premises that you would like to move to the cloud, you would be probably looking at combination of website, web role, and worker roles. If this is an application which fits into the purely web development paradigm, you probably want to start with website and then probably diversify and combine other building blocks as you need.
Okay, that's great.
And,
thanks.
And then from the infrastructure side, Simon, where do you see that? Obviously, scenarios where we have a really complicated platform that we want to install and run it in the cloud, and we just can't do it with PaaS because of whatever limitations. Maybe it's licensing, maybe it's some framework that's not supported there or something of that nature. Maybe it doesn't even run on Windows. Is that where you see any infrastructure side fitting in, the infrastructure as a service, the VMs fit in, or are you seeing other scenarios, or are you thinking through other scenarios where those could be used?
In many cases, our customers want to move the entire data center to the cloud, and when they replicate the whole on-premise infrastructure, they would be naturally looking at the IaaS solution just because they have probably Active Directory deployment with huge number of servers. Each of those servers would be run in line of business application, which can't be rewritten for the PaaS from scratch. So if you're extending your IT to the cloud, IaaS plays a critical role. Speaking of large application, complex applications, one example would be SAP, which is used by many or most large corporations. So now you could start thinking of deploying your SAP instance in Azure Cloud. And obviously that would use IaaS because it would be running in Azure VMs.
Great. And then from maybe you could speak a little bit to the benefits. I think a lot of people know this, but I'd like to just go over it just so people are on the same level playing field of, you know, the whole update cycle. If we were to run in platform as a service, I understand that we get some benefits as, the patching and that kind of thing. Do we get any of that with the infrastructure as a service and the websites, or how do those kind of marry up from a feature set perspective?
In infrastructure as a service, you pretty much have to manage your own VMs, but platform provides some support, like, for example, letting you spread your VMs across update domains so that your VMs would be updatable sequentially, so that in an availability set, that's the notion where you add a set of VMs into the set which would be pretty much spread across physical hardware, so that if underlying node goes down, physical node, others nodes would be up, and your VMs, at least some of those VMs, would still be operational. Similar concept would be applicable for patching when you have a bunch of VMs and you are pretty much patching them again sequentially in the way that at least one or couple of your VMs would be up in a certain point in time. So that's one of the ways how the system supports updating your IaaS deployments.
Sorry, just to dig into a little bit closer on that. So I just want to further clarify for the listeners, the availability set you're talking about is, the way I understand it is, if we have two VMs, for instance, let's say they're running IIS, our website, you know, they're running our web server, and if we put them in an availability set, and essentially Azure, the platform, needs to patch, you know, the underlying hypervisor, right? That has to happen in the cloud. So eventually that VM, even if you don't ever want to shut them down, has to be rebooted, correct?
Right, yeah.
And the availability set notion is saying, I can only, if we have two of them in there, one of them goes down for this patching, the other one will stay up. How does that work though? Like, does somebody monitor that other server and make sure it comes back up before the other one goes down? Or is there a timing thing there? Or how's that work?
Okay. So first of all, the fabric would be monitoring the Azure fabric would be monitoring the underlying hardware, underlying host, and the consistency of each VM. However, the actual updates of the guest OS would probably have to be done by, you know, consumer of that service.
Sure.
So you would just have to update, set up a strategy where you update specific VMs within that availability set. And also another unrelated feature, which is also useful for VM update, is that Microsoft would be releasing new versions of guest images if you use the base image like Windows 2012 server, for example. And you could on a regular basis simply replace your VMs with newer images, and thus you wouldn't need to patch them yourself, for example. So that's another way how you would do it.
So is that something that would happen automatically, or is that something you would get an email? How would I even know? Like, if I just fired up, you know, I used one of your out-of-the-box 2012 server, you know, base images up there, and a new one comes out, how will I know about that?
Off the top of my head, I don't really recall if you get a notification, but at least, well, not a programmatic fashion, but that information is communicated within the portal and in all Azure regular communication channels, so that information is usually available as soon as that happens.
Cool. The other question I had is on PaaS, because maybe you could delve just a little bit under the covers of when, so it's running a version of an operating system, obviously, and let's say a new version comes out or a patch comes out or those kind of things. Is there any way for me as a customer to say, no, you know, I'm running my stuff up there on PaaS. I have a couple web roles, let's say, and I know what version of operating system I'm running. I can get it from the service management API. Is there any way for me to say, I want to stay with that one, Microsoft, don't patch my server? Is there any, is that any possible?
There is a notion of OS families in PaaS. So you pretty much, the family would roughly be equivalent to a major OS version like Windows Server 2012, for example, or Windows Server 2012 R2, something like that. So you could pretty much indicate that you want to stick with a specific family, OS family, and then it would not be automatically upgraded. However, at a certain point, that particular family would be deprecated since newer versions of OS would be coming out, and at that point you would have to make a decision where to migrate manually or redeploy your application and state that you are pretty much okay with guest OS being upgraded.
Awesome. Yeah, that's cool. And then how do websites work? From an update perspective, yeah.
That's a good question. The websites are pretty much built on regular cloud services technology, like web roles and worker roles, because websites are obviously running IIS on VM somewhere in the cloud, so they use the same web roles to actually implement that regular web application functionality, and they also have worker role for purely administrative purposes. Frankly, off the top of my head, I don't recall any further update policies for websites. Maybe I'm missing something.
No, and that was my understanding as well. I just wanted to kind of get it out there in the open, but that they're at that point, you're really managing the application less. You're not really managing a lot of the stuff underneath, even the fact that there is a VM running it, right? You're not even really aware of it, right? Yeah.
And it's actually a really interesting architecture that websites team implemented, because this is a good representative case of how you would use a PaaS, base PaaS facilities like cloud services, web worker roles, and so on. So there is a really nice book on websites written by our colleague, Tejasu Redkar, who is pretty much outlines that internal architecture, how websites work. And this is really fascinating, really useful as an architecture case.
Yeah, and I guess my last question I have, sorry I'm monopolizing the time, but my last question I would have is from a feature perspective. Again, I'm thinking back to, I'm a startup. I got this idea for the next, you know, Facebook or Twitter. And so I jump in, I start using websites, or I start using PaaS. But from a feature perspective, for something to scale globally, and when I mean scale globally, I mean like some of our features we've talked about in the past, traffic manager, all the load balancing features, those types of things. Is there anything that sticks out in your mind that says, you know, that's, you're going to hit a wall there, you know, kind of thing where like, well, if you go down that path, or is it pretty much we have, you know, a feature set across these things where it really just comes down to those really complex multi-tier apps. From a public-facing perspective, I guess, is my question. Do these things have very similar feature sets as far as being able to scale to infinity?
Well, before web jobs were released, for example, websites were only like for front-end apps. If you needed to have some kind of background process and you still wanted to use websites, then you had to come up with a, you know, more complicated architecture how to integrate all that. Now that we have web jobs, you could run your background processes in your website application, and you could pretty much scale them out pretty well. And then, like you said, using the traffic manager, implement the high availability and disaster recovery patterns, if you want to protect against the data center going down, region going down. So that seems to be pretty good starting point for this. If you are a small organization trying to quickly get up to speed with moving the application to the cloud or create it from scratch.
But just to extend what Takei was asking, though, I guess from a number of instances perspective, right, in case you need to, let's say, I don't know, add like 10 instances, I'm just throwing a number out there, can both the architectures, the PaaS and the website scale that much?
You can definitely use the either auto scale out or just manually specify how many instances you want. The obvious practical limit would be if you are as large as Microsoft.com, and then probably a couple of racks would not be sufficient to host the application. So if you are really growing so much that, you know, you're running on like thousands of instances, you probably want to talk to Azure support to determine how to better squeeze your application into the Azure data center. But for something smaller, the regular features would be pretty sufficient.
Excellent. Thanks, Simon. Just switching gear just a little bit. So we talked about how Microsoft Azure has grown over the last few years, and they've also grown out into almost all parts of the world now. There's data centers everywhere. I think there was some public information recently that Microsoft is contemplating a DC in India as well, which would be nice. But is most of the growth coming in from the U.S., or do we see other parts of the world also, you know, there's a lot of activity around the world in all the areas where we have data centers? Or is it primarily focused in the U.S. at this time?
I don't think I have any numbers off the top of my head, but Europe is really active, for example, and in many cases the PES, a lot of different PES applications are being deployed there. So it's global in the sense that wherever we have our data center or region, there is a really good demand for Azure services. And obviously, Microsoft is interested in expanding it further. So the demand is definitely there.
Okay, that's good to know. And the other question I had for you, Simon, is, I work a lot with financial customers as part of my job. And I got to say, that's one industry that has not taken very kindly to the cloud yet. They keep claiming about, talking about these, you know, the data security aspect of the cloud and things like that. I mean, are there any such other challenges that you know of that are preventing customers from moving to the cloud? Like, why wouldn't a customer not go to the cloud?
Many customers pretty much come from regulated industries, and in each such industry there are all kind of standards, whether governmental or industry standards they have to follow. So as a result, those kind of customers are really keen on knowing that the cloud provider is certified for this particular standard or this particular, I don't know, process. There are all kind of standards like HIPAA for healthcare, PCI for financial companies, and so on. So Azure is working hard on getting those customers pretty much comfortable enough to start moving the application to the cloud as well. So this is the most non-technical reason why they wouldn't want to move it. In some cases, it just takes them a while to, be ready to move to the cloud and relinquish control of their applications which were deployed on premises.
Yeah, I do believe that's a major thing. The whole politics of how you manage an on-premises system, that could be tough to get around.
Other question, I'm sorry. It was a point before there about the data centers and that kind of thing. I know that, like, Simon, if I jump into the portal and I say I want to spin up a SQL database, or I want to spin up, you know, a storage account, or I want to spin up VMs, the wizard kind of walks me through that. I can either do it like a quick or a whole custom create and put in all my little parameters about what I want to create up here. And then at one point, doing all that stuff, it's going to ask me, you know, where I'm going to deploy this thing to, right? What region I'm going to put this thing to. Is there any way for me to see that info, like in a grid or like, not, I don't want to say a spreadsheet, but is there any other place to go see that other than walking through the wizard? Like if I said I live in Brazil and I want to deploy a SQL database, does my data center offer that? Or is it everything's offered in every data center?
Well, there is a breakdown, I'm sure documented, but it's also available through the portal, where it says which data centers support which particular services. I'm sure there is also a way how you could use the Azure PowerShell using the REST API, Service Management API, to see which services are available there. Not sure off the top of my head, but I expect that to work like that. So between the documentation and programmatic facilities, that should be, you know, easily obtainable information.
Nice. Yeah, I didn't even think about the PowerShell. That's a cool idea.
Great. Yeah. As a matter of fact, that brings us to two, I don't know, I want to say somewhat controversial questions that I'm going to ask you, Simon. We ask all our guests these questions, so don't take it the wrong way. The first is actually related to PowerShell. Cale, you like to ask this question. Go ahead about the usage of PowerShell.
I'm not even sure what you're referring to, so go ahead, Simon.
So the question is whether PowerShell is really, you know, being used in the real world. Do a lot of people actually use PowerShell, or do people use more of the management API and the portal combinations? Is PowerShell as a scripting approach, is that something that is used a lot?
Well, pretty much every large organization will have to use PowerShell just to manage their large server base when they move to Azure. Mature IT organization would always expect everything to be scriptable and repeatable, and to be sure that all the infrastructure can be reproducible in the cloud. There is also, apart from PowerShell that you run from on-premises, pretty much from your workstation, which uses Service Management API, Now you could use Azure Automation to run books that contain PowerShell commands to run administrative tasks in the cloud.
Mm-hmm.
So the difference is that with the PowerShell and Service Management API, it's implied you do it from on-premises. In Azure Automation, you have your own environment in the cloud where you run those commands to perform administrative tasks.
Excellent.
Yeah, and I guess for even like the startup type stuff, anybody coming from, you know, the other side of the fence, from a Linux side potentially maybe, or even a Mac side, where they're using that platform more. I'm not sure who does that, but no, I'm just kidding. But there's a large number of people out there, and, you know, they don't have PowerShell because they're not running on a Windows platform. And I think we have a pretty good SDK feature set there, though, on top of our REST API to allow all those other platforms to work pretty well on top of there. But maybe not quite as polished as the PowerShell. I don't know. Is that in line with what you think as well, Simon, or anything?
Well, Microsoft pretty much provides alternative administrative tools as well. We have that. I actually forget what they call it. CLI, I think. If you are a Linux user, you can use that particular way how you would manage your artifacts in the cloud. And there is a lot of efforts underway, as you can see from our recent announcements, where we are collaborating with Open Source World to bring various administrative tools that they use to the Azure cloud.
Great. Excellent. And then the second question I had for you, a controversial question, is what's your take on the new portal versus the old one?
Well, right now I'm personally still using the old one just because...
I knew it. Yeah. Didn't I tell you that, Kale, last time?
Most are.
Right? To do any work, you have to use the old portal. Anyways, go ahead, Simon.
I guess I'm just used to the, you know, list of services that I can see right away. So I'm pretty much focusing on the, you know, middleware and as opposed to UI for my whole career, the fancy UI is not something I'm used to. So I'm just using the simple list or PowerShell for that matter.
That's good, Simon. Thank you. Well, Kayla, those are all the questions I had. Is there anything else you had for Simon?
No, I think that's pretty good. I mean, it's hard to cover an entire platform in a couple minutes. So I think Simon's done a great job kind of delving into the questions we asked about, you know, the platform in general from the, you know, infrastructure and cloud service and websites perspective. I mean, there's so many features up there. We could, as you know, we've done 40 shows now, and there'll probably be 40 more, but the thing just grows like a weed, and so it continues and continues to add features. And so I thank Simon for coming and discussing all the features.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks a lot, Simon. Right, Kale, thanks again for everything, all the questions and answers.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.